is made possible by the View Conference, the biggest computer graphics conference in Italy. Our dates for 2023 are from the 15th to the 20th of October. We hope to see you in Italy or online. For more information about View Conference, please visit our website, viewconference.it.
Hi, everyone. I'm Ramin Zahid, editor-in-chief of Animation Magazine, and I'm thrilled and honored to be your moderator today for our fantastic 2023 Oscar-nominated animated features. We got six fantastic, brilliant directors with us today, and they've been working hard for so long. And over the past year, they've been talking about the movies, and we're so glad that they could join us today. Starting from the square, right next to me is Joel Crawford, the amazing director of Puss in Boots, The Last Wish. Next to Joel, we've got the brilliant Mark Gustafson and the fantastic Guillermo del Toro, the directors of Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio. Next to them, we have the brilliant Chris Williams, the director of The Sea Beast. Next to Chris, we've got the amazing Domi Shih, the director of Turning Red. And last but not least, we've got Dean Fleischer-Kamp, the director of Marshall the Shell with Shoes On. Thank you so much for all for you joining us. And to start things off, maybe we can just talk about the scene that you're most proudest of, the most challenging one, and the scene in your movie that you thought it was just beautiful and turned out the way you wanted it to and it's close to your heart. Joel, kick it off.
All right. Coming into, us taking on Puss in Boots after, over 10 years, it was like we took some big swings stylistically, but also like thematically. And what I thought I would be most proud of when I started the movie was how we were pushing the style, the animation, kind of really kind of innovative approach to like a fairy tale painting. But what really, I think in the end resonated was this, there's a moment where Puss kind of is crippled by fear. And where when we were in the writer's room, we were like, let's just take out all the dialogue and just let animation do what it does so beautifully. And it's this really this panic attack that Puss has, and being able to have the audience kind of experience that same fear, but also the same hope when Perito comes in and puts his head on Puss's stomach. And that's been just something that's been really rewarding to see resonate with audiences.
We are gathered here today to say goodbye to Puss in Boots.
Puss in Boots, you are down to your last life. You need to retire.
Oh. Oh, brother cats, sister kitties, meet your new roommate.
Well,
I'm supposed to be a fearless hero, a legend.
This is a person party. That's your party.
So this is where dignity goes to die.
The years start coming and they don't stop coming.
You're Puss in Boots? Let's talk.
No hablo inglés.
¿Hablas español? Yo también. Ah, ¿de dónde eres? ¿Te gustan las siestas?
I don't speak Spanish either.
You're funny. What's your story?
My story.
What are we looking at?
Cats have nine lives. Watch! Watch! Watch!
Puss! I think you set the oven too high!
Now I am on my last life.
Oh no!
Only shooting stars!
Legend tells of a wishing star, of a single wish waiting to be granted. Kitties of Paws, I need your help.
Is the great Puss in Boots asking for help?
Well, you see, Kitty, please.
That wish could get me my life back.
Okay, okay, Possum Face. I won't make you beg. But first.
Hey, slow down.
I know what I'm doing.
What? What? What's funny? Nothing should be funny.
Shh, quieto.
Everyone is looking for the wishing star.
I'm going to wish for everything to be just right.
One's company, two's a crowd, and three's a party. That big one leads
you. You will find your reward does not come easily.
Puss in Boots?
Goldie?
Bears?
All right, let's get it over with.
without life to spare, I am nothing.
When you only have one life, that's what makes it special.
Go get him, Tiger.
Hey!
Take it easy. This is gonna be fun.
I'm strapping it.
I am Puss in Boots. The wishing star is in the dark forest.
We step through as one. Ready?
One, two. After you.
Wait, what?
Dog? Still alive?
Let's go find out.
Wait.
Mark, you're next up.
Oh, well, for me, it's a really quiet moment as well. There's a scene in the church between Pinocchio and Geppetto, and it's a really, it's an important turning point in the film. And again, it's like, there's not a lot going on, but what's happening is very, very delicate. And so the performances had to be just right. And a lot of this scene was done by a very young animator who was, he was an assistant animator when we started. And we immediately saw, wow, this guy really has it. And so we entrusted this scene to him, and he just nailed it. He got all of the, you know, Geppetto's, unease with Pinocchio, and then you see that just slowly turn in the scene as he's trying to explain something to him. So I think that scene is, for me, maybe the most successful one in the entire film.
I would agree on that scene, but not to be boring, I'll add one. the thing that precedes that scene, in which Pinocchio is assisting Geppetto into assembling the cross, and then he talks about why do they like him and not me, you know, I think it's very personal, that for me, but also it's not done, I mean, the animation is perfect because Pinocchio is asking that without regret. You know, it's very easy to make that line be supported visually by Pinocchio being fragile or vulnerable. And I think we gave the animators the freedom and the mandate at the same time to seek for unnecessary gestures. And that scene contains one of my favorites, which is Geppetto sits on the bench and then scooches over and then goes to close the lid of the box of paint and has to stop because he notices something out of order, then moves that, and then closes the box. And I think that in these unnecessary gestures is where life appears.
I want to tell you a story. It's a story you may think you know, but you don't.
Over there! What is that?
Papa! It speaks!
He's just a puppet!
No, I'm not! I'm a real boy!
People are sometimes afraid of things they don't know.
I don't understand!
Ah! We have found him! Our star!
Everyone shall love you and call your name Pinocchio!
Pinocchio!
I have something I'd like to give you. It is a school book which belonged to a very special boy.
The boy you lost? Papa!
Enough of this nonsense.
Hey, where are you going?
You tell him I love him. And I won't be a burden anymore. Hello?
The wooden boy with the borrowed soul. While you may have eternal life, your loved ones, they do not. You never know how long you have with someone until they're gone.
The boy loves you for who you are.
Guide him to be good.
back to me.
Life is such a wonderful gift.
Chris, the sea beast.
I guess it is usually the quieter moments, isn't it? The emotional moments. And I've always loved action adventure stories, and I grew up definitely a child of George Miller. I loved The Road Warrior as a kid, and really made me want to make movies. I loved Raiders of the Lost Ark, so I was really excited about these really full throated action scenes. And so we invested a lot in that big opening battle against the big monster we called the Brickleback, and it kept getting bigger and bigger and more elaborate and more audacious. And there was a point where people were kind of questioning it and saying, geez, Chris, the scene's getting pretty big. And I had this little George Miller on my shoulder saying, make it bigger, make it bigger. So I wanted to sort of pursue that. But at the same time, ultimately, it is those quiet emotional moments. And even though it turns out to be the climax of the movie, it is a quiet moment when we have this young girl, Maisie, who is confronting the king and queen and calling them out and delivering sort of like the final message. Which is that there are these occasionally these powerful interests will sort of create narratives to pit us against each other for their own gain, and she makes that point in a very sort of assertive but quiet way, and so I'm especially proud of that moment.
There was a time when sea beasts would ravage our shores, and no ship was safe on the sea. Those days are over. Today, valiant warriors battle the beasts far beyond the horizon. You're Jacob Holland, a weapon against nature's darkest design. And I'm joining your crew.
Oh, no, you ain't.
Hey, put me down! Let me go!
We'll be off to kill a monster!
You stowed away?
Yeah.
I like this kid. We're dropping you off at the nearest port.
Hunting ship ain't no place for a kid.
But you joined the ship when you were me age.
Hold on, Maisie!
And look at you now.
That's not the same thing.
Isn't it?
No, it isn't.
The Dragmore's thick with monsters.
Monsters that want to eat us.
We're not keeping it.
But he's so cute.
You and I have a different idea of cute.
Just don't move.
This be going.
I see a fire in her. Same fire I saw in you.
The monsters I can handle.
We got it right where we want it.
Wait, Jacob!
That one. She'll be the death of me. I swore I would do everything in my power to keep people safe.
You can be a hero and still be wrong.
The ocean has sent us its worst. Then we'll send it right back.
I've always wanted a pet.
That's not a pet.
But I already named it.
Let me guess. Blue.
Aww. And Domi.
I think all my favorite scenes ended up being in Act 3. And it's a tie between the super bombastic action sequence where May's mom as a giant pandazilla crashes her boy band concert. And that all came together at the very end. And we kind of it was all of us kind of collaborating, like layout, animation, writing, story, and we were like boarding and trying stuff out and like in the camera and like music coming into it. Like that was the moment where all of the elements kind of came together to try to express this idea that May didn't have to choose between honoring herself or her family, that it was both, it was all of it. And like every element in the movie had to reflect that. And it was so cool to hear a demo from Ludvig Göransson that like kind of road tested this idea I had in my head of like mixing Taoist Buddhist chanting with boy band music with orchestral score and hoping that it all came together in an emotional way. But he like filled around with some stuff and he sent it, and it was amazing. And from there, like going immediately into this very quiet moment in the bamboo forest when May finally sees her mother, you know, as a teenage girl, like it's a very quiet moment, but it's also like again, like very much like what this movie's all leading towards. Like it felt like in the movie, like the last step to her coming of age, which is realizing that her mom is not a monolith, is not a monster or a perfect goddess who could do no wrong, but she's just a human with all of the flaws and insecurities and fears that that May had. In that moment where they're kind of like walking quietly through the forest, and then you see as the trees kind of wipe through, like past the camera, we see her mom kind of growing up into the very buttoned up kind of person that we know her to be for the rest of the movie. Like I thought that worked really well. And plus it was very minimal too. Like the score is just a flute. There's no dialogue, and it's just one single shot of them walking through the forest. I think that's my favorite scene too.
Let's go.
I'm Maylin Lee. I wear what I want, say what I want, 24/7, 365. I know, it's a lot. But I don't got time to mess around. Je me fais ma blanc. All about the hustle, am I right? Poor town. This is gonna be the best year ever, and nothing's gonna get in my way.
May May, breakfast is ready.
It's coming.
It's gonna be me.
Is everything okay?
I'm a gross red monster! Don't look at me! Stay back!
This happened already?
What did you say?
Our ancestors had a mystical connection with red pandas.
Are you kidding me?
This little quirk runs in our family!
Sick. I've always wanted a tail.
I'm a freak.
We love you, May.
You're our girl.
Whoa. You're you.
Any strong emotion.
Yes.
Will release the panda.
Abby, hit me. Oh.
Do you know how dangerous this is? You'll get whipped up into a frenzy and panda all over.
I've been perfect little May May. But maybe I like this new me.
Mama's girl.
Stop!
It's gonna be me.
And Dean, how about your favorite Shell moment?
First of all, I just want to say, hearing you guys talk, I was just like flabbergasted at all of the great animation that you guys created this year, and all those scenes, just reminding me of all those scenes. Wow, it's incredible. It's such an animation rich year, and it's representative of so many different styles and types of stories, and man, I just love all of them. Thank you for putting them out there in the world. I think that Guillermo, what you said about the unnecessary gestures is where life appears, I think is like such a great succinct way of putting this thing that I wish I'd had that phrase to say during production, because it's always the small little things that you end up having to justify in your mind and to producers and everything, because with animation, you know, everything is so precious and it takes so long just to create a frame that those are the first things to go. But they really are like that texture, and that that is often, yeah, where intimacy grows between characters, and that's how an audience gets to, you learn more about a character pulling a drawer out and shutting it than you do maybe a whole monologue. Yes. And so I think that's probably part of the reason that almost all of our moments are these quiet moments that are sort of irreducible and so specific, but mine is on trend with that too, which is, there's a moment, sort of the emotional climax of the movie when Marcel is pulling, having second thoughts about doing this interview and disturbing their environment, maybe his grandmother's, not long for this world. He's worried about the stress and he tries to back out, and she encourages him to go through with it. And my writer, co-writer Nick Paley and I had so many long conversations about what that incredibly moving monologue will be. and in the end, we banged our heads against walls for months writing it. And then in the end, part of the reason that I work with Nick is that he has a great way of finding that irreducible truth at the bottom of stuff and putting it like as succinctly as possible. Ultimately, so we wrote all these monologues. Ultimately, Marcel asked what's going to happen, or what if everything changes again? And his grandmother just Nick was just like, this is after like week four of wanting to like walk into the ocean. Nick was like, well, she just says the truth. And I was like, what's the truth? And he's like, it will, but she would say it with a smile. Mm-hmm. And that moment, I think it also, Joel, what you were saying about a quiet moment, letting the animation do the real, you know, writing and storytelling in that moment was, that's the key to it. I mean, that is the truth. That is also what the movie's about. And it also allows this moment to not get bogged down with the specifics of some trying to articulate it cerebrally or intellectually, and telling the story through animation. And Ijo Lee, who animated that shot, just knocked out of the park.
All right, so
I'm making like a little documentary.
Oh, it's like a movie, but nobody has any lines, and nobody even knows what it is while they're making it. No?
Tell me about what's life like.
It's pretty much common knowledge that it takes at least 20 shells to have a community. My cousin fell asleep in a pocket, and that's why I don't like the saying everything comes out of the wash. Because sometimes it doesn't, or sometimes it does, and they're just like a completely different person. So it's actually only two of us now. Myself and my grandmother, Nana Connie. We like to watch 60 Minutes because Leslie Stahl is fearless. Nana, make the noise. Sometimes I find my mind wandering, thinking, what would my family think? Do you think they could be out there?
Marcello. Forget about being afraid. Just take the adventure.
Okay, let's do it.
Hi, everybody. It's Marcel. I'm recording this video because I'm looking for my family.
Marcel the Shell and the Search for a Family reunited. Marcel, how long has it been since you've seen your family?
I couldn't tell you, but a space in my heart gets bigger and louder every day.
Dean, do you know how long?
That's 2 years.
2 years.
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice to know.
There's so many places that they could be.
Marcel the Shell with shoes on.
You are beautiful.
There must be so many others like me.
He has got got to go. Not that I don't like Arthur.
Not that. I'm out.
No. Oh, my God.
Arthur.
No.
Arthur. I would love to hear your thoughts about where do you hope animation will take us next? What is the next stage and what are you excited about? Joel, we can start with you.
Yeah, it's like, Dean, like you're saying, this is such a beautiful, amazing year for animation. Yeah. Like everybody has, and not just on this panel, so many films that were not nominated as well that are just beautifully done, that are pushing animation to new places. And I think it just is like I'm really excited about where animation will go, because I think like all of us probably have had the experience of meeting with young animators who are in film school right now, who are talking about how these films this year are really resonating with them, and they're excited to take it to new places. And I think already just seeing how, like at DreamWorks here with Bad Guys and Puss in Boots, that the studio has allowed us to like really kind of find the style that supports the filmmaker's vision. Like that it's like the movie is a specific way to express a sentence, right? And the more tools you have to do that, the more specific that sentence becomes. Yeah. And I think what's been wonderful is to see, like, that's what animation needs to continue doing, is telling specific stories that aren't just the box that they've kind of been put in the past. And so I don't know. I will stop talking because I'm really excited to hear the rest of you guys talk and preach.
Thank you, Joel. Mark, you're up next.
Well, the truth is I have no idea. What I do know is that, you know, none of us is a messiah who's going to come along and change everything. It's going to be a whole bunch of things that come together. And I think that, you know, there's an old saying that pound the ground where you are. And I think that's what each one of us has to do. And that's what we have to encourage the next generation to do. Just pound the ground where you are. Because there's no big event that's going to happen that's going to change this. It's going to be in little increments. We're going to change it one frame at a time. And that's the best that we can do.
Well, you'll see how Mark and I work together, because I agree with him. I think that's there's not going to be a tidal wave. We have to crumble that wall through mildew. You know, where it's not a wave hitting the wall. We're going to corrode it from the inside. I find it hopeful. Domi and Joel were talking. I'm the way Bad Guys and Turning Red have pushed the elasticity of the boundaries between 2D, 3D, and the elasticity of the rigs and the painterly stuff. There is so much new on Turning Red, so much new on Puss, so much new on Bad Guys, et cetera, et cetera. Chris, when I saw his movie, I was just blown away by, the geeking out on the simulations and the renderings, and, you know, there's everything is moving forward, Marcel, thematically, so on and so forth. The thing is that we are in a moment, I think that we came out of what I call the confetti years in streaming, where everybody was throwing the confetti, and these are the sweeping years. Everybody's now regretfully sweeping the floor. And I think we're going to find a contraction just at the same time that we have an expansion, technically, mm-hmm. expressively, artistically. And this is a weird moment. But I think if you animation as an art form should be where it is in animation schools. You see all the graduate exercises, they're so full of inventiveness, verb, ferocity, you know? And then you see that domesticated by an industry that is incredibly reactionary, quite honestly. And I think that clash is interesting. The Spider-Verse, Hollywood understands money. I have great faith on Spider-Verse pushing again. I have great faith on Bill Damaschke joining Warner's because I know Bill, et cetera, et cetera. There are changes of the guard that could be interesting. Mm-hmm. But I think it's up to every one of us. I mean, and each of us creates an accident that it makes it worth living in this medium. Tommy directing Turning Red the way she did, the way she pushed for, I mean, it's such a boys' game, animation. It's such a boys' game, and the fact that she's there, a multitude of people comes in through her work, an army, and the fact that we founded and created an animation studio for stop motion in Guadalajara, Mexico, and Mexican animators animated, 1,000 people come through that door. So it's an interesting time. We'll see. I have hopes only because I'm not an optimist. I'm a hopeful person, but not an optimist.
Beautiful. Thank you, Guillermo. Chris, what do you think?
Boy, I think a lot of things. I do have to say, I genuinely love every single movie that's represented here today. And to Joel's point, there were many more that could have been nominated that were great. I don't know if there's ever been a year like this in animation. The variety of genres and tones and looks and stories is pretty incredible. And but there is, I think, some frustration that we've been feeling and expressing about limitations that people are still trying to impose on animation, and mostly coming from the studios. And I think that joke they tried out every year at the Academy Awards has really become a lightning rod for this conversation, where that joke where they essentially insinuate that animation is something that kids like, that adults have to endure, right? And I think we've had enough of that, right? But I find myself, I guess, one of those animation veterans now, and I'm able to take the long view, and I actually see a lot of progress. You know, when I went to Sheridan College to study animation over 30 years ago, it was a time where animation really was synonymous with Saturday morning cartoons, and people largely thought of it as an art form for kids. And Aladdin, I think, had come out, and Little Mermaid, and so Disney was happening, but it wasn't nearly what it is today. And when you think about how far we've come, you know, with the Disney becoming sort of the massive thing that it is, and then the birth of Pixar and DreamWorks and Illumination, and the appreciation that has grown for anime and Miyazaki and on, right? And movies like I Lost My Body, that was just incredible, and on. And so I do think we've made a ton of progress, but that doesn't mean we should be settling for that. You know, we have to keep pushing forward. So I do feel hopeful. I feel optimistic. I mean, after a year like this, how can I not? And there's just so much energy and excitement. And I think we're all collectively feeling pretty proud of our industry right now and optimistic about where it's going.
Can I say something, Ramin? I would ask if you guys agree, before continuing, if we could all the nominees, if we could all make a letter to the Academy producers and tell them, please don't make those jokes this year. Please help. You know, we all made an effort to create movies that push the medium. Don't push it back with a stupid one-liner or a stupid goddamn joke. If you agree, I will start it and bounce it around with everybody. We edit it, and if we can all sign it, it would go a long way.
Let's do it.
Yeah. Yes.
I know that Phil Lord and Chris Miller would sign that letter, that's for sure. Yes.
That's fantastic. You heard it here first now. All right. Don't let us down. Fantastic. Domi, it's up to you now.
Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, I agree with everybody. I love what Mark said about pounding the ground where you're standing. And yeah, I'm hopeful, but I'm also wary as well. It's like Guillermo said, like, this is the moment where we're sweeping up the confetti. But I feel like in times where there's more limitations and more boxes and tightening of budgets and belts, that's where a lot of the most creative things can emerge. I feel that way about myself. Like, the more I'm put in a box, the more I just want to punch out of it. And I feel like that might be the case for the animation industry moving forward right now, that you're going to see a lot of like really cool and interesting kinds of shows and movies that are trying to work around all of these like limitations that that the studios are trying to put upon them. But then I also visited Sheridan and a bunch of other animation schools recently, and it was really cool like to see that this is the future, that now enrollment in animation schools is 75% non-male, which is like amazing. And that gives me so much hope for the future too, that we're gonna start seeing or continue to see like more diverse stories and storytellers in the industry. And it's just about, putting it upon ourselves, like for every project that we, take on, that we're pushing out of that box a little bit more every single time. Yeah.
That's great. That's great news. Thank you, Doni. Thank you. Dean, what is your take?
I agree with everyone's perspective here. I think we're obviously at a very interesting point for animation. In a lot of ways, I think what is really cool is that, sorry to sound like such a teenager, it's cool. but I think it's very cool that the focus on the conversation has been, or at least like with some of our films, definitely my film, and I know like Apollo 10 and a half and stuff, there's so much talk about, well, what is or isn't animation? And a lot of it felt largely negative to me. But I think that it's actually a really great thing, because even if it's frustrating for people who are trying to push the genre in, more of a hybrid direction, but I think it's a good thing. We should at least acknowledge that we are at a place where even live action movies have so much animation in them that we're having to have a conversation about what constitutes an animated film or not animated film. I mean, I think my ultimate goal would be that, that animated films are up for best picture as frequently as live action movies are. So while that's, frustrating for somebody like me, it's also a really great thing. My father is was a Freudian psychoanalyst, and he retired recently. And I was like, why? And he's like, well, there's just not that much demand. He also lives in Richmond, Virginia, so he's probably the only Freudian psychoanalyst around. he was like, there's not that much demand. And I was like, oh, is that, is Freud becoming out there? And he's like, no, it's just that all of his good ideas have been absorbed into mainstream culture, and everyone knows what a subconscious is, and anything. Everyone's analyzing their dreams. The mental health is the topic of discussion everywhere. Also, props to you, Joel, for creating what I think is the first animated panic attack. I feel seen.
made your father proud.
yeah, big time. but I think that is, it's such a cool place to be right now. And I also think it's evidenced by the fact that everyone on this panel, the movies are so different. Probably maybe the only thing that unifies them is that none of us could have made our movies even a few years ago, or let's say 10 years ago. And that is a really cool thing. It's never been, while there are, strictures being kind of placed on animation, and we feel ourselves like, pushing up against them a lot of the time, it's also never been easier or a more agile time to push back against those boundaries. So I think that, there's so much going on our movie, I'm sure on all of y'all's movies, that was innovative. We're in a time of innovation, and that thing rules.
We see a lot of questions coming from young filmmakers, animation students. So I'm gonna try and address a lot of those questions with one question. If you could go back to your younger self when you were a student, perhaps, or just starting out in animation, what is the one thing that you would tell yourself, one piece of advice that you would tell yourself for your future career as a director?
I remember there's this art school is a very special time where you're just, you're surrounded by all of these talented fellow artists, and you're being inspired by them. And then there's also, you're thinking like, I'm paying a lot of money for school, in my case. I was like, I hope I get a job one day. And this kind of feeling of like, wanting to like, know what's my style? What will my mark be? And like that question, like artists ask themselves of, and it's, I feel like finding your style is finding your voice, where it's the sum total of, filmmakers that inspire you, life experiences and hobbies, and then being truthful in the expression of that. And so I think it's like, just, it's like the kind of advice I'd give to younger me is just like, just relax, be a sponge. And, you know, a sponge not only takes in, but it just, you know, you express it out and just be. And I think there's something that letting the stress go of trying to solve the future and just enjoy the moment that you're in at, you know, right now and who's around you.
Well said, Joel. You took all my material, but I do think I would tell myself to just listen to those around me and observe, and also the most important thing, and I don't know why it took me years and years and years to figure this out, is something that you mentioned, which is the truth. The only thing that matters is the truth, and that's what people respond to. So I would say, hey, don't try and put something out there that you think is going to attract attention or is what people, you know, want to see. Measure everything you do against the truth. And if you do that, you're going to be okay.
Guillermo, pearls of advice.
Well, I think that one thing that is, it may be difficult to explain, but enjoy who you are, including the defects that then will become your qualities. I mean, I think when you're young, the things that make you not fit and the things that make people say what you're doing is not good, sometimes they become your style. People, it's not just your virtues that you need to hone. You need to really wonder about your defects. And if they are essential to you, they're not defects. They're virtues that have not been seen properly. I remember one of the things that I was very stubborn was I wanted to mix where I was, middle class Mexico, with myths, grand myths, you know, the vampirism, great fiction, and they were saying, well, these things don't belong in there, and I continue doing it, mixing civil war with a ghost story or this, I'm completely hard-headed silliness that makes sense to me. So, as you're young, a lot of the world tries to tell you what you should be, and to resist it is imperative to have a voice. And please, please think of your defects as carefully as you think of your virtues.
Brilliant. Thank you, Guillermo. That's great. Chris, tell us about your defects.
Oh, man. I don't think we have enough time. I mean, it is, when I think back about, you know, when I first was getting into the industry, it's one thing that's kind of cool is the fact that for me, it was kind of a Hail Mary. I wasn't good at very much, but I loved to draw. And so going to animation school is sort of an act of desperation. And my mom didn't know what to do with me and really sort of pushed me and advised me to go to Sheridan College. And so we've come a long way because it feels like a legitimate career choice now, you know? And the first thing that popped into my head was what Joel was talking about, the idea of just try to relax and enjoy it. But I know at the same time, the fact that when I started in animation, the fact that I was so sort of motivated by, I was sitting between Dean DeBlois, who had been in the industry for a while and was amazing, and Chris Sanders, and was so blown away by their work and all the actual physical art that was pinned up on the walls around me when I started. I was so motivated by that, and I was just driven to get better. I wasn't satisfied with my own work, and the people that I continue to work with, the ones that are the best are the ones that are never satisfied with their own work. Glenn Keane will tell you about all the things that are wrong with his drawings, and on and on. And so there is this sort of relationship that we have with our own work where we're never quite satisfied. So we have to sort of strike this balance where that is true, but we have to at the same time forgive ourselves for that. And I think that probably the most striking thing that occurred to me when I was working on Mulan, which was the first movie I worked on in the story department, was we were well into it, and it was, you know, it was a big mess. Like that's the way animation is. It's like the iteration after iteration, story reel, screening after screening after screening, and it was really, really hard to find the story. And I remember thinking at a very young age, at least I got the hardest one out of the way first, right? And then I've now come to realize that they're all that way. They're all hard, and so I think the thing that I've come to terms with is the fact that you if you work in animation, you're probably going to spend most of your career working on a bad movie because you haven't found the good one yet, right? And so there's this jeopardy of inviting people in and asking dozens and hundreds of people to work with you on a thing and invest all of their energy and all of their talent on a thing that isn't good yet. You're trying to find it. It's kind of out there. And that is a very scary game to play. But I've sort of come to terms with the fact that that's just the way it's always going to be. And so I'm a little more at peace with that now than I once was. So I would probably say that to young Chris Williams, that it's okay. They're all that way.
Yeah, that's great. It's excellent. Dilmi, what is your take on it?
Yeah, I think I have a similar kind of message as everyone else to my younger self, which is that I think connection is more important than perfection. When I was at Sheridan and an animation student, I was just so, I just had this tunnel vision of like, I have to improve my drawing. I have to get, good at drawing. I just couldn't help but compare myself to other classmates. So like, I just really wanted to get better and better and better. But then I kind of isolated myself. I only had like this like small group of friends that I kind of stuck with, and I didn't bother going to parties, talking to people, sharing ideas until like the very like end of my Sheridan experience, like fourth year, where I literally like met people for the first time that I've been going to school with them for 4 years. Smoked weed for the first time in my fourth year. And I was like, I missed out on so much. And then it was realizing that I put so much emphasis on like making perfect drawings that I forgot like why we put so much effort into like the craft, which is to connect with audiences, is to connect to someone, is to get a reaction out of somebody when they look at your drawing, when they look at your film or animation. I think I like overlook that part of animation and filmmaking, which is the connecting part, and also that animation is so collaborative. And I was just kind of in my hole for a while. I was also under a lot of pressure too, because, you know, like my parents are like working class immigrants, and they put all of their eggs into me going to animation school, and I couldn't, you know, I felt like I had this one chance to like to prove to them that like their money was well invested, and I couldn't like redo another year or take a gap year or anything. So I felt this incredible pressure to like make sure that I graduated, got a internship, got a, you know, job afterwards. There was no safety net for me, but that in turn kind of gave me this weird mentality about like trying to be perfect. But that's not what animation is about, and that's not why we love animation. We love it because it moves us, it makes us laugh, it makes us feel things. So I would just say, like, just to echo Chris and everybody else, just like don't focus on perfection.
Great advice. Thank you, Dilmi. Dean, you're up.
I would echo a lot of the sentiments you guys have. Certainly, yeah, when you're young and ambitious, it's easy to beat yourself up. I think that I would try to tell myself this thing that I came up with with my writing partner, Nick, which was, we were so sick of, you know, not having work or being sporadically employed and not feeling fulfilled creatively either, that we kind of just decided we're always going to hold one another to account about getting to know on a project. If you are launching a project, you know, it's like you were saying, it doesn't work yet. Like Chris was saying, it doesn't work yet. And you're trying to convince people, and it's, you know, it's hard to get down when you don't have a track record, you're young. And making a movie is like making, you know, it's like this little, starting a movie anyway, it's like this little beacon in the night, and you're hoping it attracts the right people, but there's no guarantee. So it can be easy to feel like, what am I doing with my life? And yeah, I should go back to school and get a real job or whatever. But the idea of getting to know was we're never going to just throw up our hands and quit on a project or an idea before we get a solid no from someone, before it is actually not just someone, but everyone that we can think to help us get this movie launched. We're never going to quit until there's someone is saying no and get out of my office and I won't validate your parking. That's basically it. And Marcel is inspiring to me for that. And it's like, seems, I guess it seems vain to say that I'm inspired by my own character, but I am always the most inspired by Marcel because he sees, he has, you know, outsized obstacles. He's living this world that wasn't made for him. But when he sees an obstacle, he doesn't see the impossible. He just sees like another obstacle that he knows he'll overcome somehow. It's not, and the universe isn't out to get him. It's not personal. It's not frustrating. It's just the latest in this endless series of obstacles that he calls life and that we all do. And I find that super inspiring. And it speaks to the resilience that is at your disposal once you learn to accept and love yourself for your shortcomings, as Guillermo started us off with.
A lot of people have questions about technology, about 2D animation. What's going to be the future of 2D animation? Do you see any developments in that direction with any of the people you work with? And what about AI? Are we all sick of AI art, or should we just give in to it? You know, those are the questions that came in. Who wants to answer? Guillermo, you want to go first? Go for it. No. No.
I said fog.
That's the answer.
Awesome. I like that. That's a good one. That's a good answer. I like that.
Well, you know, right. I'll jump in. I don't have any wisdom on this, but it is interesting. Like, technology is always advancing, and there's always a fear of artists being relevant, I would think. Obviously AI is another level, taking the person all the way out of the art. But I feel like, I don't know, like at the point when you need to use AI to tell a story for humans, like entirely, I would say, why are you telling a story for humans? And so it's that thing of like, back to that idea of what everybody's done this year in animation, continue to tell personal stories that inspire people, without worrying about the future, keep showing what human beings as artists can do, when we have something to say, when we're breaking out of the confined kind of box that we're expected to be in. Because I just think of like what, back to all the moments that people, that everyone shared that were special to them on the movie, came from personal kind of triumphs, personal inspirations. And those things to me are irreplaceable, like that in terms of technology.
I don't know that I understand it entirely, but I think I hate it. when I've seen people generate this art and say, oh, this could be Viz Dev, I'm like, well, I suppose it could be, but what about all the amazing Viz Dev artists that I've worked with and want to continue to work with, and where does it stop, you know? And so I wonder if we're going to eventually have to come up with some kind of label for our art, you know, the way they have, like, they label food is organic or whatever. like pure art. I think we're going to have to come up with something like that.
Authenticating art is just going to be authenticating what is made by a human, not the person, yes. Not the artist.
I think that's going to be necessary. And because I think that's what I'm going to want to watch. And it's going to become very muddled and very confusing, I think, very soon. And so, yeah, I am not for it.
Well, I personally like working with people. I don't know how you guys feel. that's the joy, you know, of what I do. It's the type of people that are attracted to this, you know. And yeah. If the future is always going to be this mysterious thing full of, you know, all kinds of dangers, but you know, if I was worried about the future, I wouldn't have been doing stop motion for the last 35 or 40 years, because it dies intermittently, you know. Mm-hmm. And it is an antiquated technology in many ways. But it's still vital. It comes back. Mm-hmm. And it's vital because of human beings touching these things and feeling that intimacy between, you know, the puppet and the artist. And it's just, you know, that is a thing that is going to be very, very difficult to replace in any sort of authentic way.
Yeah, I totally feel like humans, like audiences, crave that human touch and that like feeling of imperfection, that feeling of something handmade, if it is like the style, like stop motion or 2D, or even in the story, like it feels like so specific that you can tell it comes from the filmmaker's personal, you know, story. I think audiences will want that. And then my opinion on AI is that, I mean, I know it's getting better and better, but most of the stuff I've seen has been really creepy. And I have no idea if it'll replace humans. I know quite a few illustrators who kind of use it as a base, and I can see it as a tool, but not as like a complete replacement for like real art. Artists.
Yeah. I think that our tastes will always, our meaning, you know, humans' taste will always morph to be more interested in the thing computers can't do that well. Mm-hmm. Because ultimately, you know, all art is a form of expression, and it's a way of viewing the world through the artist's lens, whatever that is. And I don't think computers are interesting to us like humans are, because, you know, a drawing, a dance, whatever, it's all sort of storytelling. So we're always going to focus on what is the human element here. And even with AI images that are really incredible, half the conversation is about, well, what prompt did the person give the thing, and how did they finesse that prompt, and what was the intention? So those things, I think, will never. I don't think that AI will. I think that only the, not the only thing. I don't know where it's going, but I think the really sad thing to me is that it is going to be. So I think art and expression and movies and all those things, I think those are safe. What is not safe are the jobs that are the bedrock of support for growing artists that are just starting out in the world, like doing illustration jobs or doing, you know, whatever, little commercial gigs and viz dev and storyboarding, stuff like that will, I think that will get largely replaced, or just really contracted in terms of how many people can make a living off of that, which is sad. I don't know what, probably all of you guys, like me, sustained yourselves out of college by doing those jobs that are maybe, you know, in 10 years are going to be replaced.
Not on my watch. I'll never let it happen. I will never work on a movie where anyone uses AI.
There you go.
You know, and I think that the madness right now in any conversation, I mean, I think life is made of spheres of interaction. We exist in different worlds, the worlds of scientists, worlds of doctors, worlds of artists, and they have to remain a goddamn meritocracy. To democratize this with a tool that fakes, we're talking about truth, that fakes ability is absolutely repugnant. Mm-hmm. You know, not everybody can be an artist. I'm sorry. not everybody can express this or similar, and it can illustrate mediocrely something that whoever uses AI in their posters or in this and that, I think there's a place in purgatory at the very least for this. And no, I have bad news. Not everybody can be an artist. You know, I have bad news. I'm not a good dancer. I'm not a good actor. I'm not good at so many other things. And you know what? Neither are you. It's fine. You may become that through training, commitment, passion, sacrifice. These are the tools I'm on completely in favor. And there are no fucking apps for that. Sorry. You know, and I think to toward the conversation towards a victimization that makes these things not democratic, well, they shouldn't be. They cannot be. You know, they cannot be. That not every word has a single value. And not every sphere of existence needs to admit every fucking body. I don't want my doctor to operate on my brain through an AI that simulates knowing how the fuck is he going to open my cranium. And the same competence and the same passion and the same commitment needs to exist to art. So this is me expanding the fuck, I said.
Damn Mark, you, robots! Damn Mark, you!
Mark has seen me expand a few fogs in our...
Oh, my God. You know, the sad truth about this is there's a gigantic market for mediocrity, you know, for stuff that's just like, just good enough. That's a massive market. And that's probably where this is going to... That's the hole it's going to fill. But as someone else said here, you know, actually working in that field is how many people kind of figure it out. And so it'll be sad if that's unavailable to people because, you know, this thing has come in and just, oh, it's good enough. And it's impressive for someone who maybe doesn't have an eye or, you know, or just doesn't care, you know, because the market will dictate it.
Now we're going to ask everybody to tell us one underrated movie, animated movie, or live action movie that they always go back to for inspiration. And you think everyone who loves animation should watch it before they jump on their own project. Joel, go for it.
Ooh, so an underrated movie in live action or animation?
Yes, that you recommend to people all the time.
That...
Or a personal thing.
Say something, Joe. Say something, Joe.
Say something.
Okay, somebody else can go. We'll come back to Joe. Let Joe think now. Somebody else. Mark.
Oh, Mark. My God.
No pressure, Mark. Six minutes to go.
Okay. Well, you know, in terms of animation, it's one of the first, this is one of the first movies that really, in terms of animation, just like hit me right between the eyes. And that was Iron Giant. Yeah. Just like, it's like almost the perfect movie.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if I was going to live action, you know, a movie I go back and watch all the time is Dr. Strangelove, weirdly enough.
Right.
So, but, and I don't know what the crossover between those two is, but those are two movies that I would insist that someone watch.
Great. Guillermo, you have a lot in your mind.
Yeah. I would say very easy, simple, the Red Turtle, and the Red Turtle.
Wow. I think
that is a movie I would aspire to. If anybody had not seen it, I don't believe in underrated and overrated. That's bullshit. That's coffee shop bullshit. But this movie has to be seen as many times as possible for as many people as possible.
And 2D animation, beautiful 2D animation, right?
Exactly. Not only exquisite, pain. I mean, you know, part of what we do is be envious, mortally envious of something. I explode with pain that this is unreachable beauty.
It's beautiful. Thank you.
I was going to say the one that I go back to all the time that is... For me, it was groundbreaking, is Nick Park's early Creature Comfort short film. which is like such an incredible thing. And I always, it's, you know, obviously such an influence on Marcel and everything that we did, but I always go back to it because it is, at least at the time, I don't think that anyone had done something like that before. I think probably recording equipment had just kind of just gotten small enough to take it out on the street and interview people and use that as source material for, to tell a stop motion story. So I would highly recommend revisiting those if you haven't, or watching them for the first time if you haven't seen them. And he also did another series that I'm blanking on the name of, where he just took, he took real audio recording. It's kind of taking the creature comforts approach to another degree. He recorded, it's people, it's, there's a few vignettes, but it's people in a, one of them is people in like a sober living facility, just going about their day, and animated a whole little narrative around them. And this thing of combining, you know, real people's stories, real documentary audio with animation is always one of my favorite things.
Great. Great suggestion. Joel, did you think, did you look back at your memory?
Well, it's funny. My reason of, there's plenty of references I made to like that, seeing Akira, the you know, 1988, Akira the first time and what that did for me. And then, I mean, Iron Giant was another huge inspiration, but my brain, when you said live action or animation, popped in Bicycle Thieves.
Oh, wow.
And it's so, and I'm like, that's not what you're asking, because it's definitely not underrated, but yeah. I will tell you that, that's one of the most emotionally powerful films that I've experienced. In the debate of what a person will do in poverty, in for family, for, and back to our initial kind of conversation about what is animation. Animation can tell all kinds of stories, and for me, that was just something that inspired me from the very beginning when I saw that movie. And so it doesn't quite fit the question, but I just think it's something, I connection and emotions that we experience in filmmaking are so
important. That little boy actor is like one of the best actors in history of cinema. Right,
heartbreaking papa.
Beautiful. All right, Chris or Domi, who wants to go?
My neighbors the Yamadas is like one of my favorite movies that I love to go back to. Is it underrated? I don't know. I love it. It's and it's so deceptive in that it looks so simple, and you know, like has this watercolor kind of style, but the stories are like slice of life vignettes about this Japanese family, and they seem really like small, like there's no magic, but the magic is in like the day-to-day. In those like little like observational details about how this family loves each other, how they fight with each other. It makes me feel so happy every time I watch it. And it's like the structure of the story is just like lots of little short stories. So you can always like watch a little bit of it at any point. It's just so great. And I love the dad character so much in that movie, because he reminds me of my dad.
Thank you, Domi. Thank you. That's a great one. Chris, you got to take us to the finish line now.
Real quick. I love the short film, The Man Who Planted Trees. That one really gets me.
Oh,
when I see that, that's good, right?
Yeah.
When I watch that, I'm left with this thought that I want to be a better person. You know, how can I be better? And I examine myself. And that's a pretty powerful thing for a bunch of drawings to do, right? And then the other one, just quickly, I mentioned a bit, I Lost My Body. I can't say enough about that movie. It's incredible. It's a wild premise, but it's executed so well that you buy in. And there's this beautiful centerpiece scene where there's this really interesting, intense relationship that's formed, but it starts with the characters detached, they're communicating through a phone in the lobby of a hotel, and there's these tiny little observations where they're talking about the rain, and she observes that way up high at the top of the tower, rain doesn't make any sound, and little tiny details like that. It's just endlessly rich details that make this make the thing what it is. And so I'm a huge fan of that movie.
Beautiful. Now, I've been seeing all the comments from the audience coming in, and I can't tell you how many people are writing that they're thanking you for moving them, for inspiring them, and for literally changing their lives by making these beautiful movies. I personally want to thank you again for creating such beautiful art, six of the best movies of the year, live action or animated, best ones. And thank you for creating this beautiful art in this crazy world out there. We can always see your wonderful creations. And on behalf of everyone, I want to thank you. Thanks for coming here. Everyone at View, Maria Elena, thank you so much. I hope we can all be together one day soon, and you're all winners in our book. So thank you very much. Have a great day, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. Great. Thanks, everyone, for attending.